Hello and welcome to Sharp China. I'm Andrew Sharp, and you are listening to a free preview of today's episode.
The U.S. is just not going to let the Chinese end up dominating the EV industry in the U.S. or the solar industry in the U.S. It's not feasible.
Right. So to that end, the next question comes from the listener who hands down has the best Substack account name. I don't know in your entire audience, but of the listeners we got, this is from my obese cat, Mr. Whiskers. Mr. Whiskers asks, how long will the newly announced economic dialogue last before the U.S. grows tired of a lack of progress and finally raises more tariffs? Bill, you hinted in your newsletter Monday about it being sometime before Election Day. Additionally, will tariffs be the only punitive measures enacted? The USTR's report on the PRC's WTO compliance released this past February hinted that the U.S. was looking at various measures to respond. And this gets at another question I had about Yellen's visit. I wonder whether this was sort of an 11th hour pitch from the U.S. to change policies, change course in some way, or at least to say that they warned the Chinese before the U.S. government enacts more protectionist measures, more tariffs, whatever it may be. Basically, they can check the box here and say there was dialogue. We tried to do this the friendly way and it didn't work. Do you think that was some of what was in play this past weekend?
No, I think I was trying to articulate that earlier. I think you did a better job. That, I think, is a big part of it, is basically that, you know, the U.S. cabinet member, the Chinese find the most sort of the easiest to deal with.
Palatable, yep.
You know, she was the messenger for things have to change or we're going to do other things. You know, we're going to take action. And I think that is, and the problem or the challenge is, of course, it's April. The election is in less than 7 months. The Biden administration, I think, is highly likely to put forth more tariffs or other types of measures USTR has in its toolbox sometime between now and the election. I would guess close to the election, because if they do it now, people forget about it.
Okay.
But if you do it in maybe August, September, October, then you can brag about it more. That's just a guess. But I do think that there was a, you know, and the question is whether or not the Chinese actually understand that that was what she was doing and that's the message she was trying to deliver. Or if they think that now that, again, the questioner, the fat, oh, Mr. Obese Cat, my obese cat, Mr. Whiskers, Tashi is, he's here on my couch and he's a little bit unimpressed, but
Tashi fluctuates just like I do. He's yes. 10 pounds up, 10 pounds down. Nothing yeah. wrong with that.
But Mr. Whiskers, I think to your question, first of all, it's not a dialogue. Don't call it a dialogue. That is a bad word. It is an exchange. and they were very clear that it's an exchange.
And is dialogue a bad word because it's freighted with disappointment of years past?
It goes back to the whole process over the, you know, sort of in my newsletter, I joked, it's like, it's not 2006 or 2010. I mean, you sort of go back to the previous era where U.S. and China had all sorts of dialogues. The Chinese will dialogue all day long, every day for years.
Right. That's where they want to be.
Right. That's where they want to be. And I mean, the Biden administration is smarter. They get it, right, where it's important to talk, but it's also important that you have to protect your interests and do what you need to do and not forestall things because you're having a dialogue, which is what the PRC strategy has been for a long time. Because as long as we're talking, they maybe won't do the bad stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think we move beyond that. But again, the Chinese, you know, they're always happy to keep having exchanges. The problem is what the Chinese side and Xi Jinping are talking about this, the Chinese style modernization, you know, high quality development, this whole new, you know, new productive forces or new quality productive forces, depending on which translation you want to use, you know, all these things are setting China in many ways even on even more of a collision course with the developed economies and their sort of high-end technology, high-end manufacturing. Right. And China is a sovereign country, has a right to develop, and they have a right to move up the value chain. However, the other countries are sovereign countries too, and they have a right to protect their workers and protect their domestic constituencies and protect their economies. And so ultimately, though, I think this is the bigger picture here is we're heading towards much more of a fracturing of the globalization of the global trading system. And the WTO is, I think, going to be basically useless here.
Right. Well, and one of the things, as it becomes clearer that the U.S. is going to raise tariffs. The EU will likely do something similar, and you'll probably see countries like Brazil adopt protectionist measures as well. So as all this happens around the world, the potential Chinese responses continue to be interesting to me. So just putting it to you, on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely is it that the PRC responds by A, restricting rare earth exports and other critical mineral components, B, raising tariffs on Western products sold in the PRC, or C, funneling even more exports through third-party countries and just aggressively circumventing the tariffs? I mean,
I think A and C are the most likely.
Okay. A and C, that's interesting. So the rare earth exports and critical mineral components.
Well, because it, again, if part of if the national security piece, which is, and it's already happening, where, you know, U.S. and other and some of its allies and other developed countries say we have to develop our own batteries and, you know, other renewable energy technologies that require rare earth critical minerals. You know, the Chinese can say, well, fine, you know, ultimately those countries are going to go get these resources and process them. It's expensive. It's dirty. But ultimately, I think the U.S. and its allies will try and replace as much of the Chinese part of the supply chain as much as possible. But there's a gap there, and the Chinese have leverage during that gap period.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's one of those things where we've seen it with. What was it they raised? It was gallium and another mineral last summer. Mm-hmm. They didn't block exports, but they added some layers and the ability to limit exports.
Right. It was like an export control type measure.
Yeah. And it's raised the prices. So I think, you know, the raising tariffs on Western products in China, I'm not sure what they could really hit that would. I mean, again, the obvious target are German automakers. You know,
right.
You would want to use their toolbox to pick off, build dissent within any sort of a bloc that's forming with the U.S. and in the EU to take stronger measures against China. So yep. Germany is vulnerable because of its automakers. The German chancellor is going to be in Beijing in a couple of weeks. It will be interesting to see what messages he's delivering, but also what he hears back.
Right. Well, and the mineral components, it's interesting to me because as we talk about green energy, it's not just the finished product that China has been able to export all over the world. It's like when you actually look at how the technology works, whether it's with wind turbines or electric cars or whatever it may be, all of the individual components PRC companies also dominate in. And so there is a card to play if China wants to withhold some of that from the open market. And I've wondered for a while when they'll play it.
They control the entire solar panel supply chain at this point.
Every piece of the stack. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, every piece of the stack. And so there's already this massive vulnerability. On the one hand, you know, I have 40 now. I had 48. Now I have 45 because of a storm last year. But I have 45 solar panels on my roof. They were affordable U.S. subsidy, government subsidies, but then also, you know, the Chinese side had driven the price down. And this was 7 years ago. You know, it got even cheaper, and that's a good for the world that solar power is affordable.
Mm-hmm.
However, can you build out your grid or a big chunk of your grid relying on Chinese solar panels? And then when, you know, storms hit, they break and you replace them, the Chinese say, we're not going to sell them to you because we're now, you know, in conflict.
Right. Yeah. And this is how it will devolve if it does continue to devolve.
Right. It's not like the Chinese are going to, you know, turn on the special frequency transmitter or like backdoor thing in the solar panel and shut off your grid. Although I'm sure, you know, there'll be reports saying they could. But leaving that aside, the fact remains, if you can't replace, you know, these things need maintenance. If you can't replace them, you can't fix them because everything's in China and the Chinese say, we're no longer going to service them. You got a problem and you can't build a grid that way.
Or if you're trying to build electric cars in America, but you're still reliant on battery technology that is dominated by the PRC, you also are going to have a problem. And so you can go down the line in basically any industry.
And so, credit to the Chinese for having the vision to put together Made in China 2025, to have the vision to build out to get such a dominant position in solar and batteries. They did a lot of planning. They did a lot of subsidizing early on. And then, as all usually happens in China, the good entrepreneurs rise to the top.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, the U.S. and other countries have been caught a bit flat-footed.
Sure.
But that doesn't, but the answer to being work hard flat-footed isn't, okay, fine, just, you know, we'll take everything, right?
Toothpaste out of the tube, yeah.
Right, that's where reality, you know, intervenes with sort of the more sort of academic, idealistic approach to how this needs to be addressed.
Yes, absolutely. Well,
and, you know, one thing, too, on wind turbines, I may just pull it up. I mean, China, you know, there's one company, Sinovel, they completely gutted a U.S. company, stole all their technology for their wind turbines.
Right. Well, and that's, I mean, why
AMSC. I mean, that, you know, they were found guilty in a court in the U.S. I mean, it's just massive trade secret stuff that then built this one company, and it's a not an insignificant company.
Yes, and that's where the rhetoric on the PRC side about trusting in the market economy and the basic economic laws of the global system, all that rings hollow when you look at the reality of how some of these industries came to be dominated by the PRC. So it's a conversation that I am sure will continue all year long and well into the future. But
I'll just say on the Chinese side, I mean, and I think this, you know, again, whether or not they're actually listening to Secretary Yellen, there is going to be increasing pressure. Unless the Chinese make some significant changes, which, again, I don't think they can or will, there is going to be increasing pressure in the U.S. for stronger actions against what the U.S. identifies as these overcapacity issues.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of increasing pressure, another recurring theme of the Yellen visit was the mounting concern that PRC companies are working in tandem with Russia to shore up the Russian defense industrial base. I'll read this note from the AFP. Secretary Yellen emphasized that companies, including those in the PRC, must not provide material support for Russia's war against Ukraine, including support to the Russian defense industrial base and the significant consequences if they do so, the U.S. Treasury said in a statement. And as Yellen told journalists in Guangzhou, we've been clear with China that we see Russia as gaining support from goods that Chinese firms are supplying to Russia. Neither of us want this to be an issue with our bilateral relationship, so we're working together. So I guess my question here is why, on one hand, the U.S. Treasury is saying there will be consequences if this happens, but then on the other hand, every other week, there are reports that the U.S. government recognizes that this is already happening. So I wonder whether we're about to hit a tipping point or this is just sort of tough talk that we don't want to back up with action because the implications of more explicit action get pretty messy for everybody. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not sure either. My guess is that, you know, it's interesting. There was some new leaks right before her trip about, I think it was Bloomberg or FT broke the story about sort of the concerns about what, you know, they're not necessarily selling lethal weapons, but they're selling all sorts of things that let the Russians target better, yeah, but also make lethal weapons. And I think there is an effort underway to get the Europeans on board with some tougher action. It'll be much more effective if the EU's and NATO countries are on board as well, rather than just a unilateral U.S. effort.
All right. And that is the end of the free preview. If you'd like to hear the rest of today's conversation and get access to full episodes of Sharp China each week, you can go to your show notes and subscribe to either Bill's newsletter, Cynicism, or the Stratechery Bundle, which includes several other podcasts from me and daily writing from my friend Ben Thompson. I'm an incredibly biased news consumer, so I think both are indispensable resources. But either way, Bill and I are going to be here every week talking all things China, and we would love to have you on board. So check out your show notes, subscribe, and we will talk to you soon.